This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on August 26, 2010. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good afternoon. The open session for Thursday, August 26, 2010 will now come to order. As an initial matter, before we get into the substance of our meeting, I would just at the outset like to acknowledge a number of visitors we have with us here at the Commission today. We have a number of members of the U.S. Army Claims Service based in Fort Meade, Maryland. This military agency includes one of our own, Dominique Dillensager, who's an attorney with us here at the agency down in the Enforcement Division. We also have Mr. Uldrich Fior, who's the Director of Soldier and Family Legal Services for the U.S. Army, and Colonel Reynold Masterton, who's the Commander of the Claims Service. I just want to say that on behalf of the Commission, I would like to welcome you here today. I hope that your visit here has been informative and educational, and I'd also like to express my appreciation and thanks for the service that you perform for our country. So, again, welcome to the agency. First item on the agenda is the Commissioner Weintraub.
Sorry. I beg your indulgence for a point of personal privilege.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to publicly acknowledge, although she isn't here today, the service of our former general counsel, Tommy Duncan, who recently left the agency. We have Chris Huey here, which is terrific, our deputy general counsel and acting general counsel. But Tommy was with the agency since 2004. As the commissioner, worked with her the longest. I felt particularly close to her. During the time that she was here, the agency conducted 20 rulemaking proceedings, defended 25 lawsuits, considered 103 advisory opinions, held 153 executive and open meetings, considered 528 MERS. And she had quite a record of accomplishment. She was a terrific professional, wise, diligent, thoughtful, even-tempered, put up with a lot from us. I don't want to take it too personally that she's moved to a position at the multi-district litigation panel where all of her bosses live in different cities than she does. But I want to, even though she's not here, I want to publicly thank her for her service to the agency and say that I personally will miss her. But, you know, we're happy to have Chris here at the table with us.
First item on our agenda is the approval of minutes for July 29, 2010. Vice Chair, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval agenda document 1051, the minutes of the meeting of July 29, 2010.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. On the agenda today, we have a number of late submitted documents, so I think we'll try to wrap all of those up in an omnibus motion on that front. So, Vice Chair, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of documents so the Commission may consider agenda items 10-53, 10-54, 10-54A, and 10-55.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Next item on the agenda is the discussion of draft advisory opinion 2010-14, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. We have a presentation by Joshua Bloom and Amy Rothstein, and we have counsel for the DSEC who is here to answer any questions that we may have, and please take a seat at the table. Mr. Bloom, when ready, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Agenda document number 10-53 is a draft response to a request for an advisory opinion from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, a national committee of the Democratic Party. The DSEC asks whether the Act and Commission regulations allow it to make disbursements from its recount fund before the date of the upcoming general election in November to prepare for recounts or election contests that may occur after the general election and to defray the costs of soliciting donations to the recount fund. The DSEC also asks whether it may allocate the cost of certain expenses that are attributable to both recount activities and campaign activities between its principal campaign account and its recount fund. Based on the information provided, the draft concludes that the DSEC may perform both actions, provided that none of the recount activities or the results of those activities can or will be used for campaign activities before the date of the general election, and provided that the DSEC follows certain accounting and reporting procedures set forth in more detail in the draft. We received no comments on the draft. And finally, we request the authority to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that presentation. Any questions or discussion on this draft? Commissioner Walther.
I have no questions, but as I understand it, there is an agreement to approve this, so I would so move.
Any discussion on the motion? Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I would offer a friendly amendment to authorize the General Counsel's Office to make technical and conforming edits to the draft.
Any further discussion? If none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you, Mr. Elias.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Bloom. Next item on the agenda, draft advisory opinion 2010-15, Pike for Congress. We have with us today counsel for requester, Mr. Swoboda, and if you'd like to take a seat at the table. And we have a presentation by Ms. Wallstriker from the Office of General Counsel. And when ready, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Agenda document 1052 responds to an advisory opinion request submitted on behalf of Pike for Congress, the authorized campaign committee for Douglas Pike, a first-time candidate in the 2010 Democratic primary for the House of Representatives in Pennsylvania's 6th District. The request asks whether the Federal Election Campaign Act and commission regulations permit the committee to refund two undesignated contributions made by the candidate prior to the primary election, on the ground that the candidate intended the contributions to be for the general election and that he is not a candidate in the general election. The draft before you concludes that although the two contributions are treated as primary election contributions, they may be refunded to the candidate. We did not receive any comments on the request or on the draft.
All right. Thank you for that presentation. Any discussion on the draft? Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of the draft as set forth in Agenda Document 10-52 and authorize the Office of General Counsel to make any technical and conforming edits.
Any discussion on the motion? If none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you, Ms. Wallstriker. Thank you. Next item we have on the agenda is the final rules and explanation and justification of the coordinated communication rule. We have a presentation by the Office of General Counsel, Ms. Jessica Selenkoff, and others. I'm sure on standby if needed to add further details. But when you're ready, Ms. Selenkoff, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Commissioners. You have before you Agenda Document 10-54, Draft Final Rules with Accompanying Explanation and Justification for Coordinated Communications, and Agenda Document 10-54A, proposing an amendment to Document 10-54. These agenda documents would amend the Commission's Coordinated Communications Rules at 11 CFR 109.21 in response to the decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit in Shays versus FEC, which found aspects of the content and conduct prongs of the existing coordinated communications regulations invalid. If the Commission approves the final rules and ENJ, the Office of General Counsel seeks authority to make technical and conforming changes to the draft. I'd be happy to address any questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you for that presentation. Discussion or questions on this draft? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I would like to thank all the staff people who worked really, really hard on this over a long period of time, starting with Jessica Selenkoff, Joanna Wallstriker, Esther Hayden, Amy Rothstein, Rosie Smith, Chris Huey, Tommy Duncan in absentia, Claire Rajan, Sam Brown, Eric Hallstrom, Brad Lipton, and Eric Wang, who was here past midnight last night on his birthday. What a trooper. This was quite a heavy lift, and I'm sure there are other people, and I can't even remember anymore. We're all a little bit bleary. We've been working really hard on this. I am relieved that we have made it to this day. I'm at the same time frustrated that it's taken this long. I'm frustrated with the court that told us that on the last go-around, if we came up with data to support the last version of this rule, that it could be sustained, and we came up with a whole bunch of data, and it still didn't get sustained, and we ended up in this situation where we had to redo it again, which was really quite an effort. But that decision came down over 2 years ago. At the time, the court said it was remanding the regulations in the hope that as the nation enters the thick of the fourth election cycle since BCRA's passage, the commission will issue regulations consistent with the Act's text and purpose. And unfortunately, we have let another election cycle go by without having effective and compliant coordination rules, which is, I think, sad. And I think we've just got to do better. We've got to do better than this. And I know that it is possible to do better because, as I said, we've done this before. The last time the commission considered coordination, the petition for rehearing in that case was denied on October 21st, 2005. We had an NPRM out December 14th, 2005, and a final rule adopted June 8th, 2006, 7.5 months later, including having put out a supplemental notice in the interim when we didn't get the kind of data we were hoping for in the initial round of comments. We commissioned some data. We put that out for comment and analyzed that. And I remember well the policy staff and the IT guys were just phenomenal at pulling together the analysis back then. Everybody was really churning. During that same 7.5 month window, we put out new rules on the internet, solicit and direct, federal election activity, a definition of agency, electioneering communications, I think electioneering communications was in that window. And right in the middle of it, we had major turnover at the commission, where half the commission turned over. I'm sure Commissioner Walther remembers that. He came on board at the beginning of January 2006, and we had him voting on a final rule on, I think, agency was the first one by the end of the month, which, by the way, is not the record because I think I voted on a final rule about a week after I got here originally in the first BCRA rulemakings. You know, in any event, I know that it is possible to get rules done quicker than this, and I think that we really, really need to do better than this. This just isn't good enough. I know that this agency has come in for a lot of criticism over the years. Some people say we were designed to fail. I don't know about that, but plainly we were designed to compromise because we can't get anything done without four votes, and there are never more than three of us on one side of the aisle. So we really need to do a better job of doing that. And I think this rulemaking was a particularly tough one. When we started, I really didn't see the way forward. I thought, well, three of us want PASO, and three of us want, I wouldn't even know how to describe it. It was sort of like a functional equivalency test on steroids, pumped up with extra restrictions thrown in. And I thought, how are we ever going to find a way to come to a rule? And as I said, when we started out, I supported PASO. I still would be happy to adopt a PASO rule. And in fact, I will move a PASO rule, but I don't think it's going to make it. Maybe I'll be surprised. But again, we needed to find a way to compromise. And oddly enough, Citizens United, a case I don't usually have too many good things to say about, to me, pointed a way. Because when I read Citizens United, although I didn't find much that I liked in there, and I generally find the dissent far more persuasive than the majority opinion, I thought that its discussion of Hillary the movie and why it was the functional equivalent of express advocacy was really intriguing, because I thought that it made clear, oddly enough, that the way I conceptualized the functional equivalent of express advocacy actually was pretty close to the way the court seemed to be applying it. The court in CU made clear that the functional equivalent of express advocacy really is more than magic words. And it's not a null set. It's not a hypothetical construct that never actually gets met. There actually are things that don't have magic words in them that are the functional equivalent of express advocacy and therefore can constitutionally be regulated. The fact that issues and policies are discussed in a communication doesn't automatically mean that it's not the functional equivalent of express advocacy. And very importantly to me, the court explicitly said that how the communication would be understood by most viewers is relevant to the determination of whether or not it's the functional equivalent of express advocacy. Now, having said all that about what I found most significant in CU, I recognize that what I found most significant about that was not going to be the same thing that my colleagues found most significant or the issues that they would choose to emphasize. So what I proposed, and this was back in March, was that we take that standard and just use the court's words without trying to elaborate on how the court described it. We just take what they said in WRTL, we take what they said in Citizens United, and say we will be guided by that as we go forward, and not try and do a whole lot of elaboration or interpretation of that. And the point was, in my mind, to come up with something that I thought nobody could disagree with, because it was just saying we were going to follow the Supreme Court. And indeed, how could we not follow the Supreme Court? For reasons that were a little bit fuzzy to me, it's taken us from March till now to actually get it done. And obviously, it needed to be fleshed out, and staff needed to write a bunch of stuff around that. But for me, that really is the crux of what we're doing today. We are adopting outside the windows. We're adopting it for all purposes, but it's going to be most significant outside the windows, the functional equivalent of express advocacy test, which I acknowledge doesn't go way beyond express advocacy. If you think of Venn diagrams, you know, if the magic words express advocacy is a circle, there would be another circle around it that represents the functional equivalent. It's not going to be way out here, but it does contain real content. It is something that's meaningful, and I do think that it complies, most importantly, with the court's directive to us to come up with a standard outside the windows, outside the time windows, that contains something beyond express advocacy to regulate. So for me, as I said, that's the most important part of it. I would be happy if people want to move it along to make my PASO motion and get that out of the way, or other people could talk. It's, you know, however people want to go forward.
Any further discussion at this time, or would we like to move to a motion? If there was a motion on PASO.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is one of those late submitted agenda documents, agenda document 10-54A, which would effectively replace the functional equivalent of express advocacy standard in the main document 10-54A with a PASO standard. And I move the approval of agenda document 10-54A with the understanding that if, by a miracle, it passes, we would then have to direct staff to revise the explanation and justification.
Any discussion on the motion? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I waited for the motion to weigh in. I really haven't said anything publicly about Shays 3. It hasn't come up until now. It came down while I was, I think, pending in the Senate for confirmation, and walked in, and that and FEC versus Davis came out right before I was sworn in. There's been a lot of case law since the time I was walking in the door here and now. The more it changes, the more it stays the same, I suppose, because really, for the coordination rules, this is the same old debate that the Commission has had for years and years and years, which is what is the content standard that then triggers the application of the coordination rules, meaning potential investigation and that sort of thing. Years ago, there were some MERS that came out, and there were well-written statements of reasons. Brad Smith had taken the position that the court in Buckley had defined the term expenditure a certain way, and that was how you defined expenditure regardless of whether or not speech was coordinated, meaning if the expenditure or if the content contained express words of advocacy, then the second step was determining whether or not it was coordinated and thus subject to the contribution limits or coordinated spending limits, depending on who you were and what part of the act you were reviewing. Others, Carl Sandstrom, for example, took the position that the content standard, once if you have coordination, is not the standard articulated by Buckley for the term expenditure. Both argued the case persuasively, and it's a divide among those who study the subject that really still exists. Chase 3, I guess, sort of resolves it, but not really, because here you have a situation where you're talking about ads that are far, far away from the election. And the commission in previous rules had said that once you get closer to the election, the more they're going to look at your conduct. But they did say, the commission did say in rule that express advocacy triggers the content standard year-round as it should. The Chase 3 court, it's an interesting opinion for a whole host of reasons. First, they purport to say that express advocacy was the only year-round standard. That's categorically not accurate. Republication of campaign materials was also something that was year-round. And there's a whole host of other things in the Chase 3 opinion which I find just remarkable. For example, in page 22, they say, here, by contrast, the coordinated expenditures the commission's rule allows often will be as useful to the candidate as cash. And they quote a portion of McConnell for that proposition. But, of course, under the rule, they wouldn't be coordinated expenditures, because expenditures and coordinated expenditures was a defined term. They would have been permissible. So the rule never permitted coordinated expenditures. It always prohibited coordinated expenditures as the term expenditure was defined. But what they really told us to do is go beyond express advocacy for the year-round standard. It's taken a long time for the commission informally to work through all the ups and downs of this. I think it's been time well spent. The thing to keep in mind is that any ad run in somewhat of a rather broad proximity to the election is governed by the coordination rules. Any express advocacy is always governed by the coordination rules. So there are rules on the books. It hasn't been the wild, wild west. I was not concerned with the time it was taking, because it's not a presidential cycle. Presidential cycles, people start advertising much earlier. So far this cycle, I don't think there has been much in the way of barrages of outside advertising. So the concern that people were exploiting some loophole, I don't think is well-founded, nor do I think anyone's really making that accusation. So I may be just torching a straw man there. But ultimately, what Chase 3 told us to do was to come up with a rule that rationally separates election-related advocacy from other activity falling outside FECA's expenditure definition. There's that word expenditure again. So if expenditure doesn't mean what the Supreme Court in Buckley said expenditure means, then what does expenditure mean? Well, there's a couple different choices, I guess. One is maybe we can use the judicial gloss that limited the reach of the electioneering communication statute, which was not an expenditure, that was a different concept. Maybe we can use that to define expenditure if there is sufficient conduct to justify it being deemed the same as cash, for meaning the same as a contribution to a candidate. That's the view I think is the best view for a number of reasons. Among them, it's a standard that is a judicial gloss on the reach of our jurisdiction, which is really what the coordination rules turn on, and that's always been the sort of linchpin of the debate, how far the commission can go, and it's a test that is designed to do that. Two, it is a test that the Supreme Court has said is objective, although in Wisconsin Right to Life, a number of justices had said they didn't think it was objective at the time, because it comes out of at least the life of the test comes out of a plurality opinion in Wisconsin Right to Life. Of course, the functional equivalent idea was first hatched in McConnell, so really the election and communication statute was limited out from the get-go, but they really didn't expand on what that meant. It took a couple cases to get there. And then, of course, in Citizens United, they actually said something was the functional equivalent of express advocacy. One thing I would suggest to do, though. And another reason why this, I think that's the better approach, is we have a number of ads in Wisconsin Right to Life that we know are not the functional equivalent of express advocacy. The Supreme Court has said those are not campaign ads. So merely because you run an ad talking about judicial nominations, that's not the sort of thing that the campaign finance laws reach. We have a movie that the Supreme Court said is the functional equivalent. The one thing I would suggest is that people ought to watch the movie, not just read the summary that the court provided. I've watched the movie start to finish. I've asked some of my colleagues informally, have you watched the movie? And the answer was, well, no, I watched part of it. I didn't watch the whole thing. Watch the whole thing, because the movie actually does contain magic words, and it contains all sorts of, in effect, express advocacy a la MCFL. What surprised me about the Citizens United description wasn't the statement by Justice Kennedy writing for the court that, you know, most reasonable people would think it's nothing but a campaign ad. It was, I don't think there's anybody who thinks it's not. I mean, Citizens United made the argument, but really, having watched the movie, there is no other way to view the movie. And I watched it with an eye towards finding some sort of policy issue or some kind of issue ad sort of thing. It's 100% Hillary should not be president, and it really but says it, and at one point it does say it. So it really is remarkable that movie is not express advocacy. It's a functional equivalent, which is something that isn't really relevant today, but that'll be relevant because this is a debate that's always, I think, going to be with the commission. But for me, that's the Wisconsin Right to Life test is the best we can do. It may not work. I think it's vulnerable to attack because it is a judicial gloss on a different statute. And it'd be curious to see if the commission gets attacked from the other direction this time around. Maybe it gets attacked from both directions. But on its face, I think it's sufficient, and it's really the best we can do because it is a test that the Supreme Court has said is objective. And people in the who have to live under it have some sense of dealing with it because they've had to live under it. Now, the PASO standard is currently on the table, and I can't support that in the context of the rule that's currently being proposed for a number of reasons. First of all, PASO is a standard that Congress put into McCain-Feingold to regulate party committees and candidates with respect to what kind of money they can use for certain federal election activity. The commission in McConnell pointed out to the three-judge panel and the Solicitor General to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed that it applies to party committees. They're sophisticated political players, and most importantly, party committees are presumed to be doing election activity. That's why they're parties. Parties certainly can do other things, but unlike outside groups, private citizens and whatnot, non-political committee types, there's no presumption that they're a sophisticated political player. And moreover, it's not a limitation, or at least on its face, the McConnell Court said it's not a limitation on speech. It's not a spending limit. It's merely the kind of money you can use to do federal election activity designed to avoid circumvention, so it's been characterized as a contribution limit. As a practical matter, I'm sure there are going to be test cases someday which illustrate why it's probably a spending limit in some instances, but that's not before us today, nor could it be, because, well, that's something you go to a court to do. But PASO itself is a standard that Congress put into place for one purpose. I don't think it can be exported into a wholly unrelated purpose, meaning it can't be imposed on private citizens and outside groups to determine whether or not what they made was an expenditure. After all, when Congress put in PASO on the party committees, merely because a party committee PASOs a federal candidate, that doesn't subject it to the coordinated expenditure limits. It's not an expenditure in that context. It's merely a limitation on the kind of money you can use. You have to use hard money, not soft money. Even if the federal office holder has a seat at the table when the party committee decides how it's going to be spent. So a federal office holder presumably can know full well that the party committee is going to do get out the vote in his district, and that just has to be hard money. It's not subject to a coordinated spending limit. To use PASO to impose such a limit on private citizens treats outside groups and private citizens differently than the party committees. The courts used to seem to say that parties did have a special place in American politics, and I think they do. But certainly the court has made clear that you can't treat some folks differently than others, particularly when it comes to speech rights. That's really one of the main thrusts of Citizens United. So to take PASO outside of the context that it's being used by Congress and sticking it on folks that it was never intended to apply to doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Second, let's look at what Congress actually did. Congress had McCain-Feingold, Shays, Meehan kicking around for quite a while. In earlier versions, in fact, the version that passed the Senate, they did say that express advocacy was not to be the standard when it came to coordinated communications. That did not survive final passage. That is not the law. I don't see how we can then take another part of the statute that did not get passed by Congress in this context and apply it in this context, meaning the context of coordination with respect to outsiders. We're not Congress. We can't fill that gap. There were not enough votes in Congress to impose PASO in the coordination regime. It's not up to us to fill that gap and do so. I don't think it's something that we have the power to do. And people, I think there can be a reasonable disagreement on that. I think Congress left it to us to decide the standard. But because the one standard is a judicial gloss and the limitation of jurisdiction, I think that's a better fit than the PASO standard. And coupled with the fact that Congress did not mandate it. With that, Mr. Chairman, I can't support the motion, but I appreciate the time to explain why I cannot support the motion. Thank you.
Further discussion on this motion. Commissioner Walther.
I support the PASO approach, and I have a statement in case we get that far today, but I think it's the standard that makes the most likely compliance with the Shays Court. I understand the position of Commissioner McGann, but we are required to come up with something that complies with the order of the court. And that, to me, is something beyond the functional equivalent of express advocacy by its very definition of that. We can argue about what Citizens United does to Wisconsin Right to Life, and I think there will be a lot of argument about that, too, whether there's a gloss that's put on it that makes it seem more broad than Wisconsin Right to Life did when we first read it. So, but I think we, even today, we look at PASO in our rulemaking today, and I think it can be a standard that people understand. They said, even though the court said it's particularly understandable to certain segments, the court said it was understandable to ordinary people. And I think that's really a standard that we've not seen a lot of enforcement issues over in terms of how to enforce it and what it means. So I support it.
Further discussion. Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and briefly thank you to all of our colleagues and to OGC for all of your hard work on this rule. It's taken a lot of hard work for many people, and in particular, thank you to Eric Wang, who was here all day on his birthday, and he's been working on this with us since we got here. The rule did take longer than any of us wanted, but as Commissioner McGann suggested, there were a lot of discussions over the past year, however long we've been talking about this, with a lot of different proposals. We ended up on the proposal that Commissioner Weintraub did propose several months ago, but that wasn't an easy place to land for me. We tried time and time and time again to get her to agree to the WRTL standard on steroids, as she calls it, which would have made it more explicit in the rule that there should be some kind of nexus to the election. As Commissioner Weintraub points out, we like different portions of the Citizens United case, and that was relevant. That was well borne out when we had the hearing on this issue. Of course, the Supreme Court, in our view, talks about the nexus to the election, and in particular, when the court says the movie's consistent emphasis on the relevance of these historical events to Senator Clinton's candidacy for president. So they directly tied in the Supreme Court, and that was language that was very important to us. And of course, we can continue to consider that language. It's just not in the rule in the same way that we would have preferred it. In addition, we spent a lot of time trying to come up with examples that would illustrate what is specifically covered by this standard. And unfortunately, we weren't able to do that. So we had to rely on the examples that have been used in the Supreme Court, as you'll be able to see in the ENJ. So it wasn't just that, you know, there was a proposal made and we just sort of sat around thinking about it for months and months. There was a lot of back and forth, a lot of careful consideration. We are very concerned that we don't want to chill issue advocacy speech. In a lot of groups work with federal candidates, the president, a lot of other people, and we just want to make sure that they know what the standard is before they start running some kind of issue ad, and they're not, and they don't, their issue advocacy is not chilled by an overly broad standard. So the motion on the table is on the PASO standard. That's a very easy vote for me. We got boatloads of comments. The vast majority of our comments said that the standard was vague and overbroad, and I never saw a serious argument for adopting it. So that'll be an easy vote for me, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Further comment or discussion? Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unlike my colleague, I guess I do see serious arguments for adopting it because I do think it is the best way to separate election-related speech from non-election-related speech. And although I do think it is the best, I think it is time that we do adopt this rule. So I will be ultimately supporting the other standard that we have proposed, and I'll be happy to do so at that time. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'd like to just make first a few kind of general broad comments about the process that led us to this point. As Commissioner Weintraub pointed out, the Commission has gone around the track a number of times on coordination, and I hope and I certainly and somewhat expect that maybe this will be the last lap we'll make around that track. That's at least maybe that's a naive hope. I can't say that anybody is happy with how long it's taken us to get here, but I would also point out that although it may come as a shock to many of you, several people on the Commission have strong opinions and have strong views on how the law works, and those views don't always line up with one another. And so there's a lot of hashing out that has to go on behind the scenes in order to get to a point where we reach a compromise, where we find somewhere where we can all land. And sometimes it's easier to get to that common ground, and sometimes it takes a little bit of time. Again, I think that that everyone has argued in good faith and has legitimate points. We are not always agreeing with one another, but I think that I think that everyone was ultimately looking to try to get something done. And today, at the end of this meeting, not to count my eggs before they hatch, I think we will be able to say we have gotten something done. I would say that, you know, to anybody who wants to know how we've been approaching this, every commissioner has painstakingly reviewed the Chase 3 court decision, probably dozens of times, has gone through every page of comment that was submitted, the hundreds of pages that were submitted, and as well as participating in several hours of hearings on this matter. And so it's it also should be pointed out that during the course of this, the legal landscape has been shifting, and in some cases rather dramatically. And that's a relevant background fact when looking how this process has taken place. So, notwithstanding all that, I am happy that it looks like we are going to find a place where we can land. It seems to be kind of the cliche that we say with all of our rulemakings, not everyone gets what they want. But I think that we're in a place that's where we've been able to forge a majority in support of an approach that I think works. As to the specific motion before the commission, again, I don't think it'll come as a surprise to my colleague Commissioner Weintraub that I won't be able to support it. I agree with the reasons that have been set forth by my colleagues Commissioner McGann and Commissioner Hunter. The Chase 3 court asked the commission to go back and develop a rule that rationally separates election-related speech from other speech that that has a non-election purpose. And I think that PASO has the potential to sweep too broadly into the realm of pure legislative and policy-related speech and would threaten to sweep that within the realm of the coordination rule. And for that reason, I can't support it. I would fear that if that were adopted as a content standard, that it could lead to speakers hedging and trimming what they're saying. It could lead to intricate case-by-case determinations, things that the Supreme Court has warned this agency against and has warned Congress against. So I won't be able to support the particular motion that's now before the commission. Any further discussion, or are we ready to vote? Commissioner McGann.
You made me think of something, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for getting the second bite of the apple. But for me, I don't think it's a question of it might cause people to hedge and trim. I think there's actually record evidence that it does. The commission has, in past years, undertaken massive investigations over so-called coordination when the ads themselves were issue ads. Labor unions went through this. The group funded in part by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce went through this, and the Christian Coalition essentially went bankrupt in its investigation, which went to court, and the Christian Coalition ultimately won in a rather long and verbose 98-page opinion. Of course, some will say, well, that was really before McCain-Feingold. McCain-Feingold was designed to reverse all that, but I come back to the point that McCain-Feingold didn't put any detail on that. They were more worried about the you don't have to have a specific agreement to have it meet the conduct prong, but I just want to put in my two cents that I don't think it's a hypothetical that people are going to hedge and trim. I think that enough folks have gone through the ringer, so to speak, that if we get a little loose on the content standard, people are going to pull punches, and I think we do all agree that issue advocacy is something that the courts say the First Amendment protects. Of course, in the details, what's the difference between campaign speech and non-campaign speech? We can talk about that all day, but I just wanted to add that based upon your comments, Mr. Chairman. So thank you for the time.
Any further discussion? If not, nothing further on the motion that's on the table. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
No. The motion fails 3-3, with Commissioners Walther, Weintraub, the Vice Chair, in favor, and Commissioners McGann, Hunter, and myself opposed. Do we have any further discussion? Further motion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we move on to the main event, I actually would like to ask that we split out the vote on the document 1054. And the reason for that is that, although I don't think it's the big ticket item that's in front of us today, there is another issue that goes to the common vendor and former employee standard and how long somebody needs to have been separated from a campaign or the party before one would assume that whatever knowledge they had, whatever inside dope they had, either become public or dissipated in value. Originally the standard was, I think, election cycle, or was it 2 years the first time? The first time I voted on it, we shrunk it down to 120 days, which I'm sure was a compromise back then. And I suspect I originally wanted a slightly longer standard, and the court said, we had the option of either changing the rule or bulking up the explanation. And I respect my colleagues for their decision to go with the bulking up the E&J, and I wish them luck with that. I personally can't support it based on my personal experience with these rulemakings and this litigation. That hasn't been a successful strategy for me. As I said in the coordination rulemaking last time, we came up with boatloads of data when the court asked us for more data, and it still didn't seem to persuade the court. So I would have to, in order to support the rule, I'd have to have it expanded at least to 180 days. I could have supported 180 days. The desire was to go ahead with the 120 days. I truly and honestly wish you success with that and hope that we don't get sued, but I can't, just based on my personal history with these regulations and this litigation, I can't support that approach.
Commissioner Hunter.
I can support the 120 days. I don't have the same history that you do, and I think that we have additional evidence in the record that 120 days is a valid window to adopt. And so, therefore, I move the approval of rule text at 11 CFR 109.21 D4 2 little I and 11 CFR 109.21 D5 1 little I as set forth on page 58 of agenda document 10-54, and also to adopt the explanation and justification for this rule text set forth from pages 39 to 47 of the agenda document 10-54 under heading 4. Entitled Coordinated Communications Conduct Prong, Common Vendor and Former Employee Standards, and to direct staff to convey this material to the Federal Register and then to authorize staff to make technical and conforming amendments as required.
Any discussion on the motion? Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Although I would have supported 180 days as well, because I think that is certainly an appropriate standard, I do think what is most prevalent from our record is that 120 days is sufficient to answer the court's concern here. The court did not rule out that 120 days could be the appropriate time frame, but it sent the provision back to us for further explanation as to why this time frame is sufficient to prevent circumvention of the act. And although the decision by the court suggested that there may be material that retains value beyond 120 days, the record that we compiled in this rulemaking simply does not confirm that assumption. As fully described in the ENJ, we received ample testimony from campaign and committee personnel stating that campaign information, such as a master plan or polling data, either loses value or becomes public prior to 120 days. This is in part due to the changes in technology in the 24-hour news cycle, which make last week's or yesterday's campaign strategy either obsolete or a matter of public knowledge. Accordingly, because the information in our record supports the view that information does not remain valuable past 120 days and thus would not permit circumvention of the Act, I will support this motion.
Any further discussion on the motion? Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support it. I happen to be with Commissioner Weintraub when we voted for it, and I'm voting against it. But the court said it didn't work. It was a compromise. I recall quite well that was the case. We tried to come up with something that would get a consensus, and the court turned it down and said we need more data. And we don't have any more data that's empirical other than opinion, which is not empirical evidence. And so I think we still fall short of what the court expected. And I think I was at the time arguing for a longer period of time. I think Commissioner Weintraub was as well. So I would support her motion. I oppose the motion. I thought you were going to make the motion.
For the discussion, Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can support 120 days. The court didn't say it wasn't right. What they said with the problem was that the commission didn't justify the 120 days. And for me, I took a step back and asked myself what was Congress trying to do when they passed a law that said in the coordination rules you need to address this issue. And my anecdotal thoughts and recollections and hearsay evidence and my impression at the time was passed and today was the national parties and the presidential campaigns had a common practice where the folks would work on a primary, the nominee would become established somewhere around Super Tuesday, and then, like magic, everyone who works in that presidential campaign ends up working for the RNC or the DNC for, 3 or 4 months, and then all of a sudden August comes and everybody goes back on the campaign payroll. In 96, during that time period, the RNC and the DNC both started running issue ads supporting their presumptive nominees. There were massive investigations here. It came up in the audits. There were, were those issue ads coordinated? Our old friend, we already talked about that earlier. So to me, Congress was trying to get at that and preventing people who had inside information about campaigns, particularly presidentials, from going over to the party committees and then going back to the campaign and saying, oh, gee, those issue ads had nothing to do with the campaign. Moreover, You know, the other concern is someone may work for a campaign for a period of time, quit, and then work for an outside group. That group could then do ads based upon the inside information, for lack of a better term, that that person may bring to the outside group. And that's the sort of thing Congress was trying to stop. I don't think Congress was trying to stop the ability of people to get new jobs, although this has absolutely nothing to do with the anti-circumvention rationale or really FICA in general. But we did have comments about supporting the notion that sometimes folks have trouble moving jobs because of the federal election laws. You know, you have someone who's fresh out of college, works on a campaign for a while, decides to leave to get a better paying job at a trade association or a party committee, and all of a sudden there's some hesitancy to hire the person because they're afraid it may end up with an FEC, MER, and have to answer questions about coordination. So to me, 120 days is supported by the comments. It's tough to put empirical data on such a thing, but 120 days, you know, that's about 4 months. And if you look at sort of the cycle of campaigns between the primaries and generals, that's about the right amount of time. Maybe 180 is also a permissible time and can be justified, but this to me is something that's a judgment call. And we've had comment after comment saying 120 days is fine. And in fact, a lot of comments said it goes too far. It's actually too long. Data information from campaigns goes stale much quicker than it used to. As the vice chair points out, 24-hour news cycle, things move a lot quicker than they did years and years ago. And I think the commission needs to keep up with the times. Way back when, I think it was a much slower paced game. And if you worked for a campaign for a period of time, there probably was some master plan that the campaign stuck with until Election Day. Nowadays, there really aren't master plans, and if there is a master plan, it's so inherently obvious, in large part because the media has a real fascination with the inside game of campaigns. So you watch all the talking head shows, and all you see is, here's the strategy this candidate has to do to win. You know, Ohio is going to be a big state in the presidential election. There was a time where not everybody on the street knew that kind of stuff, but now there really aren't any secrets anymore in campaigns. So I guess there could be some inside information that someone could take with them, but to me it's going to get stale sooner rather than later. One suggestion I have is that at some point, once we get this sort of thing done, the commission take a look at other regulations that were passed way back in the day, late 70s, early 80s, that maybe don't really reflect the speed of the modern campaign and information. I think that would be helpful. We have some regs out there that really just seem to be from another era. And it would be a shame to have one reg, which I think this is reflects more of the modern view, and then have regs that don't necessarily reflect the modern view. I think they all ought to reflect the view that things move a lot quicker. But the bottom line here is I don't see this as allowing people to end run the purpose or the language of McCain-Feingold. I think that 120 days is supported by the comments. And what's remarkable is I don't think we have any real data, empirical, anecdotal, or otherwise, that demonstrates that 120 days doesn't go far enough. There were comments saying, well, you know, we wish it went longer, or elections, but there was no basis to support that either. So even if you want to go longer, it just seems to be an assumption that data is somehow worth more long term than maybe I think it is, or the majority of the commenters thought it is. So this may end up going back to court, and the court may say, "Gee, you tried 120 and you justified it. It seems like you're just justifying with the same sort of thing." I don't think that's the case. I think these comments were a little bit better, a little bit more particular. I know I spent quite a bit of time asking questions about this. The vice chair did the same. Everyone else did, but I particularly remember she had quite a few questions on it. So I think the record is much more thorough than it was the last time, and I think that's really what the court is looking for, to ensure that there isn't circumvention. And when you take a look at the history of the law and why it's there, 120 days is more than enough. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do want to say that I don't think there's any magic number in this case. I mean, the courts put us in this box where they say you're allowed to draw lines, but they have to be rational lines. And, you know, how much we need to support the line that we draw, particularly in an area like this where I really don't think there's a magic number out there, I think that's really a hard call. I also think there's a real difference between these two, the conduct standards that involve former employees and common vendors, and as opposed to the first three conduct standards that talk about when candidates or their agents have requests or suggestions, have material discussions, have material involvement, have substantial discussions, when there is real, we know that there has been communication between the campaign and the outside group. These are more circumstantial. What we know in these cases is that there is somebody who could have had a conversation. There was someone who might have had access to inside information and might have shared that. And the determination here is that at what point is that enough? The existence of somebody who might have had the conversation, is that enough to trigger an investigation? And I think where you draw that line is really a very tough call.
Any further discussion on the motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
Nay.
The motion passes 4-2 with Commissioners McGann, Hunter, the Vice Chair, and myself in favor, and Commissioners Walther and Weintraub opposed. Do we have a further motion?
We do have a further motion in keeping with the idea that we'll have a couple of separated votes. I would like to move approval of rule text at 11 CFR 10921I as set forth on page 59 of Agenda Document 10-54, and also to adopt the explanation and justification for this rule text set forth from pages 47 to 50 of Agenda Document 10-54 under heading 5, which is Roman numeral 5, entitled Safe Harbor for a Certain Business and Commercial Communications, to direct staff to convey this material to the Federal Register and to authorize staff to make technical and conforming amendments as required.
Any discussion on the motion? If none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. All right. Do we have a final motion that wraps up everything else that we have not yet voted on? Commissioner Hunter.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Just for the benefit of the audience, this motion is to adopt the coordination rule as set forth in the document that's gone blue minus the 120-day conduct prong.
Okay. Which has already been adopted.
Which has already been adopted. Sorry. Yes, which has already been adopted. Well, this, right. But it's not carved out. Okay. I move approval of rule text at 11 CFR 109.21C and 109.21I as set forth on pages... pages changed. On page 57 of Agenda Document 10-54, and also to adopt the explanation and justification for this rule text set forth from pages 1 through 39 and 51 through 55 of Agenda Document 10-54, to direct staff to convey this material to the Federal Register and to authorize staff to make technical and conforming amendments as required.
Any discussion on the motion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate my colleagues' indulgence and willingness to split up the motion so that I could support this, which, as I said, is the main event as far as I'm concerned. This is, as noted before, a compromise because nobody was able to get what they really wanted to get. And I wish sometimes the people out there who are never satisfied for one reason or another with what we do would remember that we do have to compromise to get things done here, and we can't get anything done otherwise. And if they think they could have gotten a better compromise, you know, come on down, you try it, because we worked real hard at this. I'm going to support this motion. I don't believe that this is going to solve all of our problems. I think it will solve the immediate problems. We'll have a rule on the book that complies with the statute, and hopefully will pass judicial muster if it is challenged, and maybe won't be. And that is, you know, that's really important. But I also think that you know, it doesn't solve all of our problems, because I think as may be apparent from some of the discussion on both sides of the table earlier, even when we're looking at the same page of Supreme Court text, we don't draw the same conclusions from it. So I'm not voting for this under the delusion that, you know, this means, you know, we're all going to be one happy family and we're all going to be voting together on every interpretation when it comes along. But this is, I think, what we need to do and have to do, and I'm going to support it. Thanks.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will support this new rule. I did support the PASO standard, but obviously there are not four votes for that, and frankly, we don't have the luxury of deadlocking on this rule. 2 years and 2 months after a court order, it's time for us to do this, and failure to reach consensus today would leave in place a rule that the court has instructed us to revise and would perpetuate what it called a loophole, allowing the candidates to evade Booker's restrictions. So I'll be supporting this final rule because I believe it is a compromise, but it is also a sufficient and appropriate response to the court order. It will separate election-related activity from non-election-related activity as required by the court. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Commissioner McGann.
Commissioner Weintraub said, if people out there think they can do better, come on down. I did think I could do better. Now I'm here. And
how's once, that working out for you?
I was under the delusion coming in. I could, you know, do a better job and write a better rule, and it's going to be great. And it, I tell you, it's not as easy as some hit look before I got here. And really, it's not really the rule text. It's the explanation and justification, particularly when you have a court, the D.C. Circuit, which for us, other than the Supreme Court, is the most important court in the country, looking over your shoulder, watching, judging, seeing if you're justifying. So the ENJ is, I mean, the rule is the page, and the ENJ is 99 pages, 50 pages, whatever it is. It's a lot of explanation and justification to say that, well, this is the best we can do. So I certainly echo that. It's very easy to sit in the cheap seats and criticize and say, why didn't you do this and why didn't you do that? And I don't understand. You didn't have to vote for this, but you could have voted for that. You know, it is something where you have to move and figure out where other folks are coming from and try to address those concerns, but still get in the rule your main thrust. Some of us had concerns that by passing exporting the Chief Justice Roberts type language could end up causing some trouble because the commission someday may read it too expansively, and that is something you alluded to as well, and that's why I go back to suggesting you watch Hillary the movie to get a sense of what really is something that satisfies the test. Because ultimately what we're doing here, as the Vice Chair noted, is what the Shea Street Court told us to do, separate campaign-related speech from that that's not campaign-related. We're not trying to solve all problems here today. We're just trying to draw a line, and we're taking a line that can be justified. Some may think it's the best line. Others think it's one of a couple lines that may satisfy the court. And the Shea Street Court itself said that we don't have to adopt the most regulatory position. We as a commission, we exercise judgment and do something that is not necessarily to the hilt that we could potentially do. So by doing this, to me, it comes squarely within what the D.C. Circuit has told us to do. They didn't mandate a standard. They gave us the option, and this is one of options. Reasonable people can disagree as to what the standard ought to be. But that's why it's a six-person commission, and here we are agreeing on this standard, and I think we agree that it is a standard that satisfies at least what the Shays 3 court said we needed to do.
Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to not vote in favor of the rulemaking, principally because, but not totally because, that we're not going to be able to adopt a PASO standard or something along that line. I want to also congratulate the commissioners for how hard they worked on this thing. I know that everyone was there till midnight last night trying to make a compromise. It was made in a very professional, hard-fought discussion over what's best and how to comply with the law. I do differ on that one point. I think it's a very important point, and so I'm going to not support it. I do think that, going back a little bit, PASO is a standard that is a little bit free right now of the uncertainty that will, I think, arise from the way in which Wisconsin Right to Life is going to be interpreted in view of Citizens United. I think there's going to be legitimate discussion and debate for some time about that. And I also think even today in this rule, we do adopt a PASO standard that will be used and to guide people who are not in the parties. It would be owners of businesses who can figure that out fairly quickly, what that means. Yes, it does pick up more, I think, election-related speech than what is the functional equivalent of express advocacy, and it's important to do that in this context. So, and I want to thank you for moving this along on the agenda. I do have to leave, and I appreciate that very much.
Any further discussion? Commissioner Hunter? Oh, no. I'll just finish by saying that I do support the motion. I think it's important to remember that the Shays 3 Court, the reason why it remanded this rule to us and its concerns were born because outside the 90 and 120-day windows, the only content standard was express advocacy, and it quoted McConnell for the proposition that the express advocacy standard is functionally meaningless. And it is important to remember that the functional equivalent of express advocacy test was established and first developed in McConnell to address concerns about the express advocacy test, which is, said were functionally meaningless. So I think for that reason, I think this meets the concerns that were set forth by the Shays 3 Court. This is responsive to it. And like my colleagues, the Vice Chair and Commissioner McGann have pointed out, this does rationally separate between election-related speech and speech that is something other than election-related. And so for that reason, I'm happy to support this as well. Any further discussion? If none, we have a motion before on the table. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Nay.
The motion passes 5-1 with Commissioners Weintraub, McGann, Hunter, the Vice Chair, and myself in favor, and Commissioner Walther opposed. And with that, coordination is moved off the agenda. Before we move to the next item, which is the final rules and explanation justification regarding federal election activity, let's take a very brief recess.
Mr. Chairman, before you do that, I'd like to just say that I really hard fought, a lot of give and take, a lot of things went on the table, went off the table, and went back on the table partially, but not entirely, up until about an hour ago. So I support it, and that record I wanted to make. Thanks.
Thank you. Just take like a 2-minute recess. The open meeting is back in order. Next item on the agenda are the final rules and explanation and justification for the federal election activity rule. We have a presentation by Mr. David Adkins from the Office of General Counsel, and when you're ready, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, Commissioners. You have before you agenda document 10-55, draft final rules with accompanying explanation and justification for our rules governing the definition of federal election activity. The agenda document would affect changes to the Commission's definition of voter registration activity and GOTV activity at 11 CFR 100.24A2 and A3, and make other changes at 11 CFR 100.24C. In response to the decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit in Shays versus FEC, if the Commission approves the final rules in E&J, the Office of General Counsel seeks authority to make technical and conforming changes to the draft. Thank you, and I'd be happy to address any questions you might have.
Thank you for that presentation. Any discussion on this draft? Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to again thank all of the members of OGC staff, and in particular Rosie Smith, David Adkins, and Amy Rothstein, who wasn't able to be here today, for their hard work on this document. And everybody on our staffs, everybody has worked hard on this for a number of months. And like the coordination rule, we've gone back and forth with different proposals. We took the comments seriously in response to the NPRM, which said that the proposed rule that we put out in the NPRM was overly broad and didn't properly consider what was a persuasive communication and what was get out the vote or voter registration activity. And we tried very hard to come up with something that accommodated the court, but also tried to ensure that the definition wouldn't cover what is not otherwise voter registration activity and is often a persuasive communication. And so we have a fairly broad definition of what is voter registration activity and get out the vote. But we also have an exception in there for brief incidental exhortations. And, for example, I just brought a flyer that I got a few weeks ago about the Adrian Fenty race in the District of Columbia, and it's a 2-page, 8.5 by 11 flyer with a lot of information about Adrian Fenty's record, the Washington Post endorsement, comparing his record against his opponent's record, and in one place on the flyer it says September 14th, vote for results, vote Fenty. So I think everyone would agree that that would meet the definition of a brief incidental exhortation on what is otherwise a persuasive communication, public communication. So I hope that that we have some success with the court again, and this rule makes it through. And again, while it's not perfect in anybody's eyes, I think it's the best we can do to respond to the court's concerns and to not come up with a standard that is overly broad. Thank you.
Further discussion? Commissioner Weintraub.
I would also like to thank the staff, particularly David and Rosie and Amy, and all the EAs and everyone who worked so hard compiling this document up until about 13 seconds ago. you know, you never know which ones are going to turn out to be the tough ones. Sometimes you think, oh, well, all the action's going to be on the other document and this one will be easy, but that turns out not to be the case. So I again, appreciate the fact that we are finally going to get to a final rule on this. I think that the court identified some deficiencies in the last rule, and particularly we have added the urge or encourage standard, which I think should satisfy the court and goes a long way to making this the kind of robust rule that the court expects us to have. So I don't really have a lot more to say other than I will support the draft.
Further comments? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Federal election activity is very important both under McCain-Feingold and to those who live under McCain-Feingold. The rule, I can support the proposal that we have before us and intend to do so, but want to explain a little bit about how we got where we are and what it means. If a state or local party conducts certain federal election activity, including such things as get out the vote, voter ID, voter registration, they have to use hard money. So the purpose there that I think Congress was trying to get at was to avoid circumvention of the contribution limits. But they didn't subject any of that to any sort of spending limit. They just imposed the kind of money you can use limit. What hasn't arisen yet is a situation where a local party tries to do some of this activity without the knowledge, input, or support of a federal office holder. So a federal officer doesn't raise any money, doesn't control the spending. It would seem to be Independent Speech and Post Citizens United. I'm sure someone's going to, at some point, come in and make a big deal about all that. But that's not what we're here to do today. We're here to try to pass a rule that defines some terms in the statute. Because when Congress passed this federal election activity section, they didn't define terms like get out the vote and voter ID and voter registration. Perhaps it's because they assumed everyone knew what it meant. They were candidates themselves. They probably still are. Some who voted for it are no longer. But they're terms that those who do campaigns understand. But the problem with the statute is there's also an exception to paraphrase the statute rather inartfully, state candidate persuasion pieces. And we heard from the commenters that that's really the difficult part, and that's really what's taken for me, at least for me, the most time to work through. Because really, you could take the Shays 3 opinion, read it, look at the reg, and if you just crossed out the words individualize and assist and change assist to encourage, we could probably have the rule done. No one would know what it meant. There wouldn't have been an explanation and justification, but we probably could have just did that quick fix. But that really wouldn't have helped anyone understand what was really going on, because to me, They're in the big. They're in the, that big a difference to what the rule was before to what the statute says. I thought the rule before was okay. Actually, when I read Shays 3, I read the portion they quoted from Mr. Shays' brief, where he describes within days of a federal election, a state party can send out multiple direct mailings to every potential voter sympathetic to its cause, urging them to vote. And blanket the state with automated telephone calls by celebrities identifying the date of the election. So I read all this, and I wrote in the margin. I thought that's what the individualized means covered. When I read this description, I thought, gee, I kind of thought that's what the rule already covered. But then there was an advisory opinion. The L.A. County Dems came in. And the way the Shays 3 court read it, when you read the opinion, it really does kind of jar you that it seemed like even though there was a federal candidate on the ballot, the commission said that didn't count as FEA. The L.A. County Dems AO was somewhat muddy on the rationale. I think it was a compromise, and the court was having none of it. So this rule, I supersedes that AO. I thought the AO was correct as to the result, simply because I read the things in L.A. County Dems as state candidate sorts of things. But you know, we have to draw lines, and the court didn't think the FEC had drawn the line at the right point there. Of course, I was in the cheap seats then when that happened. I wasn't but that was when I thought it was so much easier, and I came on down. So we have to confront this, and we have to define terms now that even the commenters had a little bit of trouble defining. Some were a little more clear than others, but really the challenge is to separate terms like get out the vote from state candidate assistance, because of this exception that says if it's a state candidate piece, it's accepted from FEA unless it's FEA. So it's kind of circular, because you don't get to the exception unless the material is already federal election activity. Well, Congress must have they must have put in the exception for a reason. They couldn't have really put it in there just to zero it out. So we had to confront that. And as Commissioner Hunter mentioned, we have this mere exhortation language designed to ensure that state and local parties can continue to do their state and local candidate pieces without converting everything into a hard money world. GOTV, talk about that for a minute, is something that I think those who do politics as a profession know it when they see it. They all say, oh, everyone knows what GOTV is, everyone except for the D.C. Circuit and Federal Election Commission and people who don't do campaigns for a living, because it does get difficult to define. It was a challenge for me, particularly when a court is looking over your shoulder and has already second-guessed other folks who are very knowledgeable to subject matters, efforts to try to define it. I felt like I was trying to define the color orange, and the court's already said that a mixture of red and yellow is an insufficient definition. So, how do we define orange? Get out the vote is what it is. And in Shays 3 itself, I think overread some of the potential loopholes, questioning whether really individualized means was enough. When a party committee does voter registration, of course it's going to be individualized. Parties don't do generic TV ads saying register to vote. They're only going to want to register people that are going to vote for their candidates. Maybe they get it wrong a couple times, but generally, unlike the League of Women Voters, or unlike Rock the Vote, or unlike groups who see it as a civic issue where they want everyone to vote regardless of what party they may choose to associate themselves with or what candidate they may support, parties are not in that game. Parties are in it to win elections, so they're not really driven by this notion of civic duty to register all voters. They're driven by the desire to register voters that will vote for their candidates so they can win elections. So it's a little bit different. There's really two kinds of get out the vote, and of course it's going to be somewhat individualized. What that means, who knows, but that language is gone from the rule. The rule, I think, is simpler, but can arguably go too far, because it seems to include things such as merely sending out materials that encourage urging potential voters to vote, which is that's pretty clear. But informing voters of the time when polling places are open, the location of particular polling places, early voting or voting by absentee ballot, this is precisely what nonprofits do, and they do it with soft money. But when party committees do it, they're going to have to do it with hard money. Fortunately, I think this is an academic exercise. We can sit up here all day and sort of come up with hypotheticals. One of the follow-up comments, Campaign Legal Center took me to task for sort of spending all day coming up with as applied challenges to all the rules. That's and they're right. That's not really what we're supposed to be doing here. But you do need to go through that exercise to test your own thinking. The reality is party committees aren't just going to send out a piece of paper that tells people when polling places are open. They're going to have something else on there like vote Republican. They're going to have something on there that looks like generic get out the vote activity. It's going to be attached to something else that really is going to be get out the vote. So although someone may be alarmed that this rule goes too far, I think as a practical matter, I could be wrong, but I don't think state parties or local parties send out stuff that only says the location of a polling place and that kind of thing. So I can support the rule for those reasons. The mere exhortation is an important concept because we don't want to convert all state candidate advocacy into FEA because I don't think Congress intended to federalize all elections. Certainly, Senator McCain has numerous floor statements, and it is much in legislative record supports that from his mouth to our ears that was not the intent, and I think we have to honor that, and I think it does it. The other things we're defining, things like voter ID. The statute says that voter ID in connection with election where a federal candidate's on the ballot is FEA. The commission in prior rulemakings defined that to mean voter ID done within a certain time period of the election. Something that I thought was important and some of us thought was important and took a lot of time to get in the rule in a certain way that others could live with was what if you have an intervening state election like a local mayoral election where there's no federal candidates on the ballot, but yet you want to do voter ID for that election. And we have a new exception in there for that, and I appreciate my colleagues, particularly Commissioner Weintraub, for working with me on that and working with us on that, because I think this is important. I have a list, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, Long Beach, California, New Orleans. These are cities that have mayoral elections during the time period. So voter ID that they would do, parties in these cities that would do for the mayoral election would be FEA, absent this exception. Even though it's not in connection with the federal election where a federal officer is on the ballot. Newark, New Jersey, Norfolk, Virginia, Glendale, Arizona, Lubbock, Texas, Newport News, Virginia, the list goes on and on. Wichita Falls, Texas, Burbank, California, all over the country, there's cities that actually have these elections. So that's actually something that I think there was a local party chair, San Diego Republican chair, testified, and that was one of his themes. The reality, though, is a lot of his comments, although one may personally agree with them, the statute says what the statute says, and the reality is if you're doing things that matter as a state or local party, meaning get out the vote, voter ID, and that kind of thing, near a federal election, it's going to be all hard. That's what Congress decided. We would love to maybe change that in the abstract, but we can't. So we have to, though, recognize that there are things we can do, and I think that does that. Voter registration, this is another area that gets confusing because, again, you're only going to register voters that are going to vote for your candidate. So you could read the voter registration reg and say, oh, my God, this covers way too much. But please take a step back and think about what a party committee actually does when it registers voters. If party's not going to do a TV ad saying go register to vote. It's not going to do a billboard that says go register to vote. It's going to instead go out and try to target voters that it wants to target, not everyone, only the people that would support it. So with that, the one thing I'm going to add just for the record back to the get out the vote, there was a lot of discussion that we had about what if you have a state candidate piece that says go vote on a certain day. There was a commenter that tried to say there was a difference between vote for Jones for mayor and go vote for Jones for mayor, or what if you put the date of the election and that kind of thing. I went and I have a library of sort of weird books, and one of them is Advertising Wins Elections by a guy named Maurice McCaffrey. This was a fellow from Minnesota who was one of the pioneers of advertising with campaigns. He was one of the first fellows to figure out that TV advertising wasn't just for presidential campaigns. He did the campaigns of folks like Clark McGregor and a number of other prominent members of Congress from back in that generation. And his book is quite funny. It's from 1962. He has a picture on the back there smoking a pipe. He really looks like a cast of Mad Men. He's kind of that generation. And he actually goes through and criticizes and critiques of billboards, his whole chapter on billboards. And he has one here where a billboard that says, keep your present school board, reelect, and it's got three names, and it has Tuesday, June 12th on the board. And he says, this is a bad poster board. It has a good message, but there are too many names to be grasped at a glimpse. Also, the election date is a space stealer. So although you're certainly going to see state candidate mail that has the election date and that kind of thing, here's somebody in 1962 saying you're wasting your money if you're going to do a billboard talking about the date of the election. So when you read these rules and start thinking about, oh, my God, the sky's falling, it's not. because as a practical matter, we're covering the things that the Shays 3 court said we need to cover. It's covering the sort of things that are going to benefit, at least in the McCain-Feingold presumptive sense, benefit federal candidates, and that's really the whole shooting match here, is the idea that a federal candidate could benefit from soft money. And that's why this is a hard money requirement. So I think that's important. I just want to take some time to put this in the record, because someone someday may listen to this, and it may matter, because it may help with people understanding why we're doing what we're doing. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the time.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner McGann, for the shout-out. Commissioner McGann and I were on the phone last night at about midnight. Never do that again.
I was just waking up.
Yeah, see, that's the problem. For me, the most important thing is that we address the court's concerns by broadening the scope with the adding in encouraging or urging assistance by any means is in here. And we covered the kind of mass communications that the courts have clearly been concerned about. Robocalls are covered. Mass mailings are covered. There are some exceptions in here. They are narrowly tailored. The voter ID exception that Commissioner McGann mentioned specifically says, in addition to the fact that it has to be conducted solely in connection with a non-federal election held on a date in which no federal election is held, also it may not be used in a subsequent election in which a federal candidate appears on the ballot. So for those who were concerned that if this kind of activity went on and was paid for with soft money, then it was going to end up being captured later on in the federal election, we built that into the rule that can't happen. So I think that those exceptions make clear that they are really solely dealing with non-federal activity, elections that aren't even on the same day as the federal elections, and are narrowly tailored and appropriately so. So thanks.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be happy to support this rule today. And first, I do want to also share my thanks with OGC and all the staff members, but also to Commissioner Hunter and Commissioner Weintraub for taking the lead on both sets of these rules that we adopted today. I'm sure I express the views of my colleagues as well, that we really do appreciate your hard work and don't envy the phone calls at midnight. I think this rule does a good job of drawing the line so that state and local party committees can't be used to make an end run around BCRA's requirement that any activities surrounding federal elections have a significant influence on federal elections are paid for with hard money. I think it is responsive to the court's concerns that the old rule had some issues with respect to loopholes and unnecessarily focused on individualized means, and I think this new standard is appropriately drawn to draw those lines. So I'll be happy to support it at the appropriate time.
I think since we're about that at that point, if there's nothing further, do we have a motion? Commissioner Weintraub.
All right, I'll do the motion this time. Mr. Chairman, I gratefully move adoption of agenda document number 10-55 so we can all go home. Direct counsel to arrange for its publication in the Federal Register and, of course, authorize any technical and conforming amendments that may be necessary.
Any discussion on the motion? If none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion passes 5-0. Just to kind of tie up something that Commissioner Weintraub said at the outset, acknowledging the general counsel who, Tommy Duncan, our former, who departed. Mr. Huey, Chris Huey, who is our acting general counsel. Congratulations on now you've made it through your first executive session, and now you've made it through your first open meeting. So you picked a couple of interesting ones to start in on.
I didn't pick them, but thank you very much.
That's right. Mr. Palmer, are there any management and administrative matters from the Office of the Staff Director?
Mr. Chairman, there are none.
All right. Meeting is adjourned.